This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
The history of human civilization is short, relatively, but scientists are exploring how people adapted or collapsed during earlier changes to their climate. That's information that could help us now as we go into a rapid shift. We're going to go back about 5,000 years towards the start of human organization, and that's when the Indus civilization formed around the Indus River of northwest India and now Pakistan. A new article in the journal Current Anthropology draws on studies by the Banaras Hindu University and the University of Cambridge in the UK. We'll talk with the lead author, Dr. Cameron Petrie, from Cambridge's Division of Archaeology. Educated at the University of Sydney, Dr. Petrie went on to specialize in the archaeology of India, Pakistan, and Iran. Cameron Petrie, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Very nice to be speaking to you.
Where was the Indus civilization? Can you put it on a map for us?
Sure. The Indus civilization is now spread across two different countries. The earliest Indus sites were actually discovered in areas which are now parts of Pakistan. So they stretch across quite large parts of the plains of Pakistan. The modern provinces of Sindh and Punjab. And then after independence and partition in the middle part of the 20th century, people started to discover a lot of archaeological sites that were in the borders of modern India as well. So it stretches across parts of the northwest part of India, modern states of Indian Punjab and Haryana. And there's also Indus populations that are known to live in the states of Gujarat as well, which is sort of more strictly western India, I guess.
And how does it compare in time with the pyramids of Egypt or the early settlements of Mesopotamia?
Well, broadly contemporaneous. So the Indus civilization has a long period of development, and the main thrust of that development seems to take place in the third millennium BC, so from around 5,000 years ago. And then around 2500 BC, the Indus civilization sort of has an urban phase. So we see the development of large urban centers. They're around 80 hectares in size, you know, probably populations more than 50,000 people living together. And that urban period seems to last for around 500 or 600 years. And then I guess in terms of comparing to Mesopotamia and Egypt, I mean, that's at about the same time in Mesopotamia. That's about the same time as the early dynastic period, the end of the sort of first phase of city-states in Mesopotamia. And then when we see people like Sargon of Akkadeh becoming, you know, ruling the first sort of large Mesopotamian, I guess, proto-empire. So, yeah, and then in terms of connections to Egypt, I mean, we're talking broadly contemporaneous with the sort of phases of the major phase of pyramid building in Egypt as well. So the Indus is comparable with the ancient complex societies of Mesopotamia and Egypt in terms of period and complexity, but it's different, of course.
And why do Western people know less about the Indus civilization, and do people from India know more about it?
It's a good question, because I think, you know, we know a lot about Egypt and Mesopotamia, and because it's sort of infiltrated into a lot of the sort of religious texts like the Bible and a lot of the other sorts of textual documents that have survived from antiquity. Whereas the Indus civilization didn't sort of filter through into the sort of Western tradition in terms of documentation. So there's no references to the Indus civilization in any of these ancient texts that survive. And there were little bits and pieces, references to regions to the east that appeared in Mesopotamian texts, but they were only really translated in the 19th and 20th centuries. So it was very much a sort of lost civilization, and it was referred to as a lost civilization when it was sort of rediscovered in the early part of the 20th century. And in many ways, it had sort of slipped out of the consciousness even within India and Pakistan. So there was people recognized that there were these ancient things in the landscape, you know, the you know, giant mounds that existed, and you know, objects were found on the surfaces of these mounds, but it wasn't really clear what they were. And, you know, archaeologists, Indian archaeologists, British archaeologists that were based in India in the 19th century were going out and visiting these archaeological sites and collecting material from them. And some of that material ended up in places like the British Museum. But it wasn't really understood until the early part of the 20th century. And since then, there's been a lot, you know, progressive amounts of archaeological research, and we're gradually sort of filling in the pieces in terms of what we understand.
At the peak, would we recognize these settlements as cities?
It's a good question, and it's a sort of debated question. But purely on the basis of their size, these are sort of, in many ways, massive entities. And, you know, they would have had populations of thousands and thousands of people. You know, they typically, the settlements either have large walls around them or they're built up on large platforms. So they would have been very visually striking. And, you know, they would have been in the middle of a sort of very, very active landscape where people were interacting with each other. But there's some things that mark them out as being quite different to what we see in Mesopotamia, for example. There's not very many of these Indus cities, especially considering the enormous area that it encompassed. So there's only really a very small number of very, very large centres. Whereas in Mesopotamia, there's lots of centres that exist in a much smaller area. So it's quite clear that they're a very different sort of social or urban fabric that exists in these different areas. So I think, yeah, they must have looked like cities in some respects, and they would have certainly been urban if you think of the difference between urban and rural. There's definitely small numbers of urban settlement in the Indus realm, but very much a sort of rural landscape otherwise. So it would have been quite something to encounter this sort of urban center, I think.
With that setting in mind, Cameron, when did a change in climate arrive for the Indus Valley people?
Well, as far as we can ascertain, around about, say, 2100 BC, so a little, you know, 4,200, 4,100 years ago, there's growing evidence that there was a weakening of the monsoon. So one of the things that marks the Indus out as being quite different to most other early complex societies is that it developed in an area which is quite delicate and nuanced in terms of its environment and its climate. So it's right on the edge of where the winter rain system comes, so a winter rain system that affects the areas of the Mediterranean and the Middle East, and where the Indus River is sort of the limit of that rainfall system. And then it's also at another edge of the Indian monsoon rainfall system as well. So it both benefits from those two rainfall systems and is quite vulnerable to changes in those rainfall systems because, you know, if you don't get enough rain, it's at the edges that it's going to have the most effect. So around 4,200, 4,100 years ago, it looks like the monsoon weakened. And as a result of that, there seems to have been less rain. And one of the questions that we're still puzzling over is precisely how long that period of weak rain extended. And on the basis of the evidence that we've got at the moment, we've looked at a series of lakes, dried up lakes in northwestern India. And in one of those lakes, we had very clear evidence that there was a sharp change. So the lake went from being a relatively shallow lake to being effectively an ephemeral lake that only filled up in the rainy season. And that happened around this point in time. So it's clear that the monsoon was weak. It's very, very likely that weakness was protracted. And some suggestions have been put forward that maybe this period of weak rain was extended for up to 200 years. And, you know, that's a massive extended drought in anyone's language. And it's inevitable that would have had massive effects on local environment and various sorts of other things. But at the moment, we're sort of just getting glimpses of how this is impacting upon the local landscape. And we know from other locations in Bangladesh and in Oman that there was a weakened monsoon in those areas as well. So we're gradually sort of putting the pieces together to work out the patterns of these climate changes that have occurred in the past.
Well, I'm about to mispronounce a word because I don't really know what it means, and I'm asking you, what on earth is a speleothem, and how are they used to assess climate?
You didn't get far off the pronunciation, but a speleothem is effectively it's like a stalagmite that comes out of a cave. And why speleothems are particularly interesting for reconstructing climate is basically they form in relationship to precipitation. So when the rain comes, the water percolates into the ground and it produces deposit formations in caves. And so these stalagmites effectively have the equivalent of tree rings on them that they grow over time. And the reason that that's interesting in terms of climate is because they're actually a very sensitive measure of variation in the amount of rain that comes. So they give you an indication of high rainfall or low rainfall over time. And the other thing that's very good for these sorts of formations is that they can be dated very, very accurately with uranium-thorium dating. And that sort of dating technique is much more accurate than the traditional method that we use in archaeology, which is radiocarbon dating. So radiocarbon dating, you get errors of up to 100 or 200 years, whereas uranium-thorium dating, you get it much, much narrower. And if all the stars are aligned, you can get it down to less than 10 years or down to 3 or 5 years and things like that. So you can actually get very, very sensitive climatic information out of such features in caves.
Now, when the normal crop system failed, did Indus cities break down?
Well, this is one of the questions that we've been really interested in exploring. So I think people have known for a long time that the Indus farmers were quite innovative and clever. And you know, because of these two weather systems, they were quite conscious of growing crops that were suitable for their local environments. So in our area, we were quite conscious about looking at how diverse their farming system was. And some of the things that we discovered was, you know, that it was actually a very, very diverse farming system. And it appears as though they were using more crops than had previously been known. So we discovered that they were using rice in the period before Indus urban cities developed. And then the use of rice continued as well. And they were using millet crops, a range of different millet crops. And both rice and millet can be grown when you get summer rain. And in addition, that they're growing wheat and barley and different sorts of lentils and things like that. And all of that can be grown when you get winter rain. So you get with these two different rainfall systems existing, farmers were able to sort of adapt their cropping systems to match the availability of water in different seasons. And I think part of the older sort of idea about the sort of Indus cropping was that people recognized that it was diverse, but there was a general view that a lot of it was focused on the winter crops. So I think some of our research was highlighting that, you know, in actual fact, the diversity is more extensive than was previously thought. And the question then comes, what happens then when the rain becomes weak and people have to sort of make adaptations? And some of the older suggestions was related to the fact that perhaps they made a switch to some of the crops that were more hardy, or they became more diverse over time. But it seems, on the basis of what we've discovered, it was that they were diverse all along. And it seems like that people were always making choices. And so that has all sorts of implications if you think about how a state operates, for example, and whether a state insists that farmers need to grow certain crops or they can grow different crops, and, you know, how people pay taxes and all of these sorts of issues and ideas. So by recognizing that their practices are diverse, it throws up all sorts of interesting questions. And you can ask, you know, how does this society operate and various other things. And then when those sorts of questions are in the mix, then all of a sudden we say, oh, and also what happened if the rain didn't come? So it's very, very interesting, because it means, you know, people are, in some respects, some of these populations and farmers are actually in a situation where they can make choices anyway. So it seems quite likely that they were able to make choices about the crops that they were growing on the basis of the real-time availability of water that was available. So perhaps they were able to make clever choices and be resilient. But one of the things I suspect that becomes difficult when you have less rainfall is to be able to feed large populations. So, you know, my personal view is that perhaps, you know, if the rain becomes weak and you have to engage in, you know, risk mitigation, you have to make decisions about which crops you grow. Maybe you grow crops in smaller fields, you can't feed as many people. And this is where, you know, over time, as far as we can work out, it appears as though the Indus cities gradually become depopulated and most of them become abandoned. And it's very possible that this is a sort of a response to the climate change event. You know, it's more difficult to feed people in large populations. It's easier to feed them in smaller populations. So this sort of fits with a bigger archaeological narrative that we see, where it looks like that the cities become less popular and we see many more villages appearing in the landscape.
I think there may be another critical difference. This is just a guess on my part, between earlier civilizations and ourselves, and that is that in earlier ages, growing food did not stop at city limits. There were crops and animals right throughout wherever anybody lived, and I think that might have helped slow down the process of emptying the cities or given them some resilience that we don't have.
Yeah, I think it's possible that the rural nature of the Indus landscape definitely made it sort of possible for them to sort of make changes and responses. And I think it's also possible that there was always a very close connection between the populations of the city and the populations of the country. And this has been thought about for a long time, actually. Scholars going back 40, 50 years have been proposing this as a possibility. And, I mean, so if you think about how populations work today, people do tend to be city dwellers if they're a city dweller. But I think in the Indus world, it's possible that you might have had extended family groups that were connected to, villages. And even today, people all over India and Pakistan have, even though they may well live in a city, they have a home village, in a sense, where their family comes from. So there may well be social mechanisms that exist that allow people to sort of leave a city and still maintain all sorts of social connections. And so, they can spread out into a landscape. The land is very much today, lots of land is being used very, very intensively. And I think when you move towards mechanization, you reduce the number of people that are actually involved in the process. And so more people are being fed off less actual physical labor in some respects. I think in the past, that wasn't so extreme. So probably when, people move out of a city or they're, inhabiting a countryside more intensively, they're able to engage in smaller scale farming. And perhaps that's sort of quite a successful method to survive in periods of change and stress and other sorts of things.
Do you think there's more knowledge that we can gain from studying the Indus civilization that might help us now that climate change is heating up for us and uncertain effects on our weather?
I think, I'm constantly trying to think of ways in which my research can be relevant other than just thinking of, oh gosh, isn't that interesting? We're learning about the past. And I think in this instance, there's a challenge because I think in many ways, agricultural production has transformed so profoundly. So if you've got, an example from the past where people have engaged in sort of successful behavior and activities where they're taking lessons from farming, it's a little bit difficult to apply it directly. But I think some of these issues about diversification and I think in many ways maybe the degree to which the ancient population was carefully in tune with their environment and not so keen perhaps to modify that environment but to live within its limits. And I mean, I think that's a lesson that wouldn't surprise a lot of people in some ways where, for example, in modern India now, there's quite an extreme use of groundwater. So there's a lot of pumping to engage in intensive agriculture. And this results in, the India's ability to support an enormous population. But it also creates incredible stresses on the environment. So I think these sorts of issues are going to become very relevant when it comes, if we have increasing variability in rainfall and we have more extended periods of drought, then some of the big, intensive agricultural projects are going to become very vulnerable. And I think populations are going to really have to think more about the intense way that they use water. And so that sort of approach of, I think being a bit realistic about, the degree to which we can actually apply information from 5,000 years ago is a good word of caution. I think it would be ridiculously ambitious to say, oh yeah, you can just apply this to the modern world. But I think it's an interesting lesson in the sense that people being willing to operate within the limits of the capacity of the land and then perhaps adapting their behavior to suit changes in the environment, I think those are helpful lessons, really.
Indeed. Could you tell us what the Land, Water and Settlement Project is?
The Land, Water and Settlement Project was something that was established in 2008, and we were given funding from a variety of different funding bodies in 2007, and we set out to really investigate the area of northwestern India and to try and get some understanding about long-term social change, long-term environmental change in this particular region. And partly because this is an area where we have evidence for the Indus civilization as this sort of first phase of urbanism in the subcontinent. And it's also an area where we have evidence for a second period of urbanism, which happens about 2,500 years ago. We see the beginning of a second urban phase. So we were very much interested in looking at long-term social change, long-term environmental change, and trying to see what the relationships were between humans and their environment And in some ways, I think one of our original aims was to look at the decline of the Indus civilization and to try and see whether there was environmental role played. You know, was there climate change? If so, how did people respond to it? And as the project developed, you know, we came upon some very clear evidence that climate change occurred, and clear evidence for all sorts of different social dynamics and changes, urbanization, deurbanization, shifts in settlement, different decisions being made by local populations. And it was very interesting from our perspective. It was quite clear that the local populations engage with, you know, broader connective networks. They trade over great distances, but they're also very much focused on what's happening in a local sort of setting. So this is, from our perspective, we were really trying to get an understanding of this particular part of India and how it was intersecting with other areas.
And now the Two Rains Project. Who's funding that? What's its aim?
The Two Rains Project was very much a sort of, in some ways, a logical extension and an expansion of what we attempted with the Land Water Settlement Project. So we were funded, the Two Rains Project was funded in 2015 by the European Research Council. And this has allowed us to bring in a number of new doctoral students and postdoctoral researchers, and we can sort of, in some respects, expand the research that we're attempting on the ground and also do it a little bit more intensively. And so we're very much focused on this whole idea, the two rainfall systems and the distinctive nature of the Indus environmental context, but then really trying to focus on this question of, does climate change actually cause collapse? That's actually the sort of, in some ways, a reasonably coarse question. But we're really trying to look at whether or not climate change is a sort of driver for these social changes. Well, you know, is climate change a real forcing mechanism? And, I mean, one of the reasons that we're asking that as a question rather than assuming that it is actually the cause is because we know, for example, that the Indus civilization didn't just sort of vanish once this climate change event happened. People don't just sort of run screaming without trying to change things, trying to adapt, trying to be resilient and trying to overcome things. So we really wanted to look at, you know, what are the mechanisms that we can reconstruct and what can we say about the landscape? What can we say about how people lived in that landscape? How did they farm and how did they make decisions? And you know, some of that is related to how they kept animals and whether they, you know, provided the animals with water even though there wasn't a lot of water available. You know, if they're trying to grow crops, were their crops under stress or were they not under stress? And these sorts of issues where we're really trying to unpack a question about climate change and collapse and really understand it in a little bit more detail rather than just assuming that those things are definitely connected.
Well worth doing, and you can find out more, listeners, in the paper Adaptation to Variable Environments, Resilience to Climate Change, Investigating Land, Water, and Settlement in the Indus, Northwest India. It was published in the journal Current Anthropology on January 27, 2017. Our guest is the lead author, Dr. Cameron Petrie. He is a reader in South Asian and Iranian archaeology at the University of Cambridge. And you can find links to all this in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Cameron, thank you so much for helping us out.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.